Information. We're doing a field trip next Wednesday. DHS, big building, small building, out by Kaiser. Well, it isn't a small building, but it's a different building. And just kind of get a lay of the land. And so we probably won't be back in the Capitol till 11. So please adjust your schedules accordingly. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2631. Representative Jensen. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. It is with gratitude that I come before you this morning, that you've made time in what I know is an extremely busy schedule that you have this session. My purpose for being here is to speak to House Bill 2631. Before doing that, however, for the record, I am Bob Jensen, a state representative from House District 58. For those of you unfamiliar with the map, that is the portions of Umatilla County that include Pendleton and Hermiston and a number of the small communities surrounding those two thriving metropolitan areas.
Representative, compared to Condon, it is a metropolitan area.
Well, yeah. At any rate, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you on House Bill 2631. First off, this bill comes to us as, or to me, came to me as a constituent issue, and not a constituent issue from just one constituent, but from a couple of constituents in my district. The kind of history on this, just a little background information, Interpath Labs in Pendleton, up until this last few months, had a practice of always providing for the patient a copy of lab results if you would come in and sign a release form. Exactly why or how they discovered that they could avoid doing that, I'm not sure, but at any rate, they had changed that policy, and I find it to be a one that that I certainly agree with my constituents is not only unnecessary, but also one that's counterproductive to the health and well-being of the people who have taken these tests. This bill then will allow patients to have direct access to laboratory records. The right to information about one's health is, I would submit, a fundamental right. It is the policy of the state of Oregon to protect the right of individuals to access, to have access to their health records, as you would find in ORS 192.525. However, under current law, ORS 438.430, lab reports cannot be issued to a patient without the physician's consent. House Bill 2631 would reconcile this conflict. Direct patient access to lab records would have many health benefits. One, a direct patient access to lab records would improve the patient's understanding and compliance with treatment. Two, physician-patient relations would improve, and communication about a patient's health and well-being would be enhanced if the patient knows about the lab results prior to the time, perhaps, that they see the physician. The continuity of care for patients would improve. Patients could truly give then informed consent based on the information in their lab results. In today's world, the world of HMOs at all, where we have changed and modified the way health care has been delivered in this country, and in a world where we are extremely mobile, such that we may find ourselves in need of health care and be hundreds and even thousands of miles away from our primary care physician, for the patients, for the individuals who have their health care records with them when traveling, it certainly can be a quick and immediate benefit to any physician dealing with that person in any kind of an emergency situation. And on a personal basis, I've had some witness to this. When I was in Atlanta one time, I had occasion to have to go to the emergency room, and the emergency room physicians were ecstatic that I was able to bring along with me my healthcare reports or lab reports from the last 20 years, I guess. They probably weren't worried about 20 years before that, but at least those that came reasonably close. House Bill 2631, then, would enable a patient to be the custodian of their medical record. And again, in today's world, very different than it was when I was a younger person, and the doctor, you know, was kind of the family doctor that you confided in and you talked to, and that even on some rare and or not so rare occasions would come out to the house, and you know, when you gave him a call. That world is gone. The world has changed dramatically as far as health care, as you all are, you know, obviously most aware. Would enable then the patient to be the custodian of their records and lab reports, and ensure then that the current doctor that they are being treated by has access to the records that provide a crucial history of the patient's past treatment. House Bill 2631 is easily reconciled with the Federal Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments of 1988, otherwise known as FLIA, and the otherwise infamous HIPAA that this committee, I'm sure, is more familiar with than they ever wanted to be. And it seems that it's about the 15th of April, is it, that HIPAA becomes the law of the land. HIPAA privacy rules require covered entities to make health information available upon the request of the patient. If it were not for FLIA, this bill that I'm proposing would be unnecessary. It would be automatically covered. However, HIPAA does provide that for laboratories under the 1988 Clinical Laboratory Improvement Act, that states have jurisdiction as to as to whether or not the laboratory has to release information to the individual. And it varies from state to state. Oregon, under our current ORS 438-830, reports shall be issued to the patients covered except with the consent of the shall not be issued to patients concerned except with the consent of the physician or otherwise authorized person. CLIA makes it clear that it is the state statute on this that would prevail. House Bill 2631 would amend ORS 438-430 to authorize laboratories to report or to give the reports directly to the patient. The intent of House Bill 2631 is not to create an either-or environment in which either a patient or a doctor can receive a laboratory report. And this was one of the initial concerns as the bill was initially drafted. And we talked to the AMA, who I understand have some other concerns, but we talked to them and agreed this was not the intention of the bill to provide an either-or sort of thing. The intention of the bill was to provide the information to the patient, and certainly not to prevent the lab from giving that information to the doctor. For the purpose, then, of the clarification, the Dash 1 amendments have been given to you, and I would like for you, as you consider this, to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. And it's a very complex amendment. It just changed four to an and. It was kind of interesting to talk to legislative counsel, and legislative counsel that was drafting the bill thought that they were still provided this, that they would still get the information. But they shopped the bill around in LC, and there were four lawyers present. And guess what the vote was? 2-2 as to whether it did or whether it didn't. This is hearsay information, you understand, that I got. But since it wasn't our intention to do that, we wanted the most clarity that we could have with the bill, and therefore graciously, willingly, enthusiastically endorsed the amendment. The amendment ensures the patient and the doctor then would have access to this. Absolutely nothing prevents doctors and patients from discussing the information received from the laboratory report. In fact, patient direct access to the laboratory report would lead to more comprehensive and thorough discussions concerning the patient's health and potential treatment. Some may criticize the bill on the grounds that patients may not be able to handle the contents of the lab reports. I'm puzzled by this, regardless of what that content is. That someone would say that an individual couldn't handle the results of it. For the most part, we have a pretty good idea what may come out of these reports before we get a lot of them, even in the very serious case. And further, this argument seems particularly unpersuasive in light of HIPAA's requirement that other medical records be immediately accessible to the patient. Patients will make the best decision when they have all of the information about their health. Treatment can only be enhanced if a patient can ask educated questions that may bring to a doctor's attention something that might otherwise be overlooked. Given the mass of information that exists today on the internet and other sources, many patients are very well educated and savvy about illnesses and diseases and would make extremely useful contributions to this, to the patient-physician relationship. Thank you for your indulgence in hearing my testimony. I would be happy to answer any question that I'm able to.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you talked to the laboratories at all and gotten their input? I'm trying to think of logistics. In Pendleton, a laboratory maybe has 10 physicians sending their specimens in. In the metro area, we'd have a laboratory that would have hundreds of physicians sending their specimens to the laboratories. And I'm just wondering, how could, you know, if you're getting hundreds of calls...
Chair Cruz, Representative Mons Anderson, with all due respect, Interpath Laboratory in Pendleton has hundreds of physicians sending information. It is a regional lab that covers eastern Oregon and portions of southeastern Washington. So, those of you who drive through eastern Oregon will see little white cars with Interpath Lab written on them as they scurry back and forth to various places to bring specimens to the lab.
But, and Representative, we've got folks from Oregon Association to testify.
Okay.
So.
And yes, I think there are people from the lab who might be able to speak to
them. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Representative. We agree with you on this very strongly. I think information to the patient is helpful. I share your concern, however, in terms of HIPAA, where even a minor mistake on the part of the lab in some way, unless it's direct transferal, could get them into deep trouble. And I wish there was some other way around that federal law and what will now become state law as well. But I think the core of what you're asking is excellent.
Representative Cruz, Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, thank you. And I think all of us have concerns, not just about HIPAA, but about all of those alphabet soup things coming out of Washington, D.C. They do represent this. And they're clear illustrations of Big Brother dictating policy for us. Not necessarily sometimes we think policy.
Any other questions? Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Cruz. Appreciate your hearing the bill.
Catherine Otto and Elizabeth Smith. Good morning.
Good morning. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman. My name is Catherine Otto. I am the chair for the Government Affairs Committee representing the Oregon Association of Clinical Laboratory Science. We are the professionals in the state of Oregon that perform the laboratory tests. And I'm not going to read my statement. I have just handed out to you. I will say to you that we support this. We believe this will increase access to laboratory test information for patients. We have a long history of supporting that. And we believe that it will also streamline the process for patients to receive their laboratory tests without even taking HIPAA into consideration. Currently, if a patient wants to have a laboratory test result, they would ask their physician to send it to them, usually after the physician has seen it. So the physician may either photocopy that and send it to the patient, or he or she may then write it or type it onto another form and send it off to the patient. This will streamline that process for the patient. We also believe that this may also help the patient in terms of the fact that sometimes some organizations, some physicians will say no news is good news in terms of the laboratory test result, and sometimes there are some situations where that information is fallen through the cracks. If we send it to a patient directly, they will have the opportunity to get that information right away. This does not also say, we see it as not every single patient will ask for their laboratory test results. Patients would have to ask the laboratory to send it to them. So it's not different case of burden in that case. Representative Montes Anderson, you talked about the fact as far as laboratories, whether this will be an increase. It will potentially be an increase, and we'll have to set up a different system. We can't speak right now to how much that cost would be in terms of that, but it will, for the overall healthcare system, we believe that will save some time and possibly some effort, and it'll be on a different end. It'll be the physician's end. We did have, Ms. Smith here has a comment in terms of a little minor change in terms of the second part at the Section 2. Okay. It's not substantive, but if Ms. Smith could speak to that.
Thank you.
please identify yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Elizabeth Smith, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association for Clinical Laboratory Science. I am a working med tech, to use the old-fashioned terms, every day at the bench. The statement at the very end of Section 2, which says, or analysis of a specimen submitted for evidence of human disease, laboratory medicine is used for a lot more than simply disease detection. We monitor health and well-being and the treatment of disease also, and we would simply ask Representative Jensen if he would be willing to amend this bill to include the traditional statement or explanation of laboratory medicine, and I'm not sure the exact wording, but I think it is goes something to the effect of, so that an amendment would be, for analysis of a specimen submitted for the maintenance of health and well-being, monitoring of treatment, or evidence of disease. This would then include such things, I mean, and I'm sure probably one of you has at least been interested in what your cholesterol is. That's not the evidence of disease. That's the maintenance of health and well-being.
Mr.
That's
Chair.
Representative Dolfo.
Could we repeat the language?
It would be, for analysis of a specimen submitted for the maintenance of health and well-being, monitoring of treatment, or evidence of disease.
Yeah, and Representative Dolto, we will double check to make sure that is the precise language to make sure we get it right. Representative Jensen, I think, concurs with that. So,
thank you.
Other than that, we are very much in favor of this.
Okay. You said disregarding HIPAA. Let's not disregard HIPAA. well, we would all love to, and you know, we know who to thank for that, but that's another issue. Is there a HIPAA issue here? I personally don't see one. Okay, you don't. Mike, would you come up? Is that what you wanted to talk about, was HIPAA? Okay.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Mike Steels. I'm the director of the State Public Health Laboratory in the Department of Human Services, and we have no position on this bill regarding whether patients should or should not be allowed to get lab results directly from clinical laboratories, but I just want to fill my honest technician in service to the legislature role here and give you a little bit of a disclaimer. ORS 438, which this bill amends, regulates laboratories. It does not regulate patients. All this does is remove the prohibition that exists for laboratories to give reports directly to patients. CLIA, as Representative Jensen correctly said, defers to state law, so there would no longer be any state or federal prohibition to laboratories, if they choose, giving those results to patients. It is not at all clear whether HIPAA is going to give patients the right to get results directly from indirect care providers, which laboratories are. Laboratories have what's called an indirect care relationship, and that's the federal jargon in HIPAA. I've been trying to find out for about the last 3 weeks whether or not patients will have the right to get results directly from their laboratories under HIPAA or not, and it really isn't clear at this point. That's my point, is that I don't think you can count on that. I may be wrong, and personally speaking, I sort of hope I am at one level, but let me just read you something from the December 28 Federal Register 2000. This is from the HIPAA Privacy Rule Guidelines. It says, although we are concerned about the lack of immediate access by the individual, but we believe that in most cases, individuals who receive clinical tests will be able to receive their test results or reports through the healthcare provider who ordered the test for them. The provider will receive the information from the clinical laboratory. Assuming that the provider is a covered entity, the individual will have the right of access and right to inspect and copy this protected health information through his or her provider. Well, that comes two paragraphs after something that reads as if they were trying to give patients the right to get direct results from the laboratory. So there's clearly some contradiction and some unclarity here, and I just wanted to get that on the record so you know about it.
Well,
I hope it gets clear.
And we will want to get credit. I'm not sure it's possible to get clarity on HIPAA at this point in time because it's a moving goalpost as we speak. But if you go back to the intent of HIPAA, Clearly, this would not be a violation of intent.
Right.
So,
And Chairman Cruz, if the purpose is to eliminate another barrier to patients getting results, this bill absolutely does that.
Right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brought this up in Judiciary the other day, and it was very clear that it could be a problem under this circumstance. A lab gets a request from a patient. The patient happens to be out of the area and wants the results sent to them, or they've moved. Their address is no longer accurate. The lab mails the results to the patient, and it gets in the wrong hands. There is no good faith exception. In other words, if you send it to the wrong place and somebody opens this, oh, hey, look, Mary has such and such, they could nail you, and there is nothing to get you out of that. That's the, as the chairman has mentioned, this is a monster. But
Except, Representative, I would think if a release was signed to release it to a point,
I don't think so.
Well, this is some of the ambiguity we...
But it's nothing we can do. It's a federal mandate.
I understand that, but...
it could be mean.
God bless the federal government. I actually wanted to say something else. That's all I could say on camera. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. I'm thinking of the fiscal impact mainly on the public health. I think private labs is a little different because they're not necessarily using taxpayer money. Well, yes, in some cases you are. But if the public lab is going to then be able to give results out, do you see that as an issue, a problem? If someone calls you and says, okay, I live right next to Portland State, I want to come down and get a copy of my TB test or my gonorrhea or syphilis or whatever test they're having done, which I know you primarily are one of many of them that you run. Do you see that as a big, can you foresee whether that would be have a financial impact?
Chairman Cruz and Representative Monis Anderson, our lab gets about 360,000 samples a year from five states, and at the other end of every sample is a patient. And I wish I could tell you how many patients or families of patients would request their results directly. If I knew the answer to that, I could give you some sort of fiscal impact, but it's hard to know. My guess is that very few would want the kind of results that we generate, except possibly the parents of newborn babies that would like to see their genetic screening results or something like that. I think clinical laboratories, frankly, would probably get a lot more requests than we would because of the nature of their work. As Kathy and Elizabeth were saying, a lot of what they do is health screening, health status monitoring, that sort of thing, stuff that we really don't do. We're mostly, as you said, involved with communicable disease of public health significance. And I don't think that many people are going to call us for their TB results, to be honest.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We won't actually stand at ease. We're just going to have a pregnant pause. I'm not sure that's a technical term.
You better be careful.
Okay, we will stand at ease for just a moment.
No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. You can tell I'm in trouble this morning because I wore my Pendleton shirt in honor of Representative Jensen, who represents Pendleton. We appreciate Representative Jensen's willingness to work with the Oregon Medical Association as we looked at this bill, as he indicated during his testimony when we first did see it as introduced. We obviously have some major concerns over the fact that the way it was originally drafted seemed to suggest that it would go to the patient or the doctor, not both. That's clearly an issue. The failure to review lab reports and to maintain those reports as part of a patient's record would not only expose potentially a physician to claims for negligence, but also constitute a violation of the Medical Practices Act. So we are, you know, in agreement that we need to make sure the bill is clear, that physicians do have access to these reports. We word the amendment a little bit differently, but we get the same result. And I've shared that with your committee administrator. As Representative Jensen said, ORS 438-430 has been substantially unchanged since 1969. And during the last 30 years, a patient was permitted to receive their lab test results if the ordering physician or healthcare provider authorized the release. Physicians, I think, would hope that more patients would become like Representative Jensen and take a real active role, not only in their healthcare, but in their lab reports and others. Clearly, unfortunately, the average physician's patient is not there yet. The only disagreement I think we currently have with Representative Jensen, and he alluded to that in his testimony as well, is we believe there are instances where it would do harm to the patient for the patient to have these results prior to sitting down with his or her physician. In some cases, lab tests may be misleading. It's currently common practice to require retesting if an HIV test comes back positive. I even checked online. There's some online testing services for HIV. They won't release those to you directly. You have to go through a healthcare provider for that. False positives occur in other testing, whether it's prostate cancer, breast cancer. Those are not potential diseases that should be faced, in our opinion, strictly from the patient's perspective first. You ought to sit down with your provider and go through the options. We're very concerned that if it simply goes to the patient first, that they would not, in some cases, seek treatment or seek to do harm to themselves. So we have a second amendment that, again, is now being shared. I shared it with Representative Jensen today. I apologize for not getting to him to that earlier. I just got this back from OMA Council late yesterday afternoon. And what that would say is that prior to the release of the result of any test, examination, or analysis to a patient permitted under this bill, the person releasing such information shall confirm with the patient's physician that the release to the patient will not be materially detrimental to the patient's health. Again, you have the Medical Practices Act in play here. You have DME rules in play here. And I think first and foremost, in some of these instances that I've described, the OMA is very concerned that they ought to be shared with the physician and the patient prior to going just to the patient. I'll stop there and maybe answer any questions.
Tim, how do you define materially detrimental?
Mr. Chairman,
that sounds like a kind of a fuzzy term.
Mr. Chairman, that would be in the physician's professional medical opinion to make that decision.
Okay.
And if you look further in the amendment, the patient's physician shall give due consideration to the standards of practice of reasonable medical practitioners in the same or similar community under the same or similar circumstances.
Okay.
So we do define that a little bit further.
I mean, as I would read this, it sounds like it would be a judgment on the impact of the patient's state of mind of hearing this information more than anything else.
Mr. Chairman, that's a fair assessment.
Okay. So MDs are now becoming psychologists. Is that pretty much it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think I can go quite that far.
Okay. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, would this really drive the cost? I'm just thinking, you know, if a physician has to read it, then he has to call the lab to say you can send it, or would it be like another office call? And just the amount of time it would take a physician. I mean, the docs that I see are just, you know, booked morning tonight anyway, and I don't want to create an undue burden on the doctors here either.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, no, because I think in well over probably 95% of the cases, this would just be a routine. The three specific instances I would give you would be HIV, breast cancer, prostate cancer, and in very rare occurrences, maybe even pregnancy testing. So I think, you know, overwhelming majority of the time it would be a...
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Tim, since LMA has access to one of the few HIPAA experts in the state, if there is such a thing as a HIPAA expert, or as close as we come anyway, could you run this by him? I personally think we're clear on this, but it would be nice to have an opinion from... we don't want to get too many lawyers' opinions, or as Representative Jensen said, we'll have too many opinions. But I would trust the judgment. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to do that. I assume you're talking about Paul Frisch.
Yes.
I'd be happy to do that. I can tell you that this bill and these amendments come from our counsel, outside counsel, Cooney and Crew, who should have looked at it from that perspective.
Okay. Paul should be able to take a real quick look at this.
I will get a report to you, Minister.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair Cruz. I appreciate your second opportunity to appear before you. I think the American Medical Association lobbyist makes a very good point that this statute was not amended since 1969. That's 32 years ago, thereabouts. The practice of medicine has changed in 32 years. But it strikes me that the association is trying to maintain here a section or a portion of a section of a statute that might have been very applicable 32 years ago, that I think may have moved beyond that. The more information, that people have from varieties of sources. B, and especially the process of delivering health care in this country has changed dramatically since 1969. For those of you who are obviously much younger, may not remember this, but I do remember pretty well the health care system at that time. And I talked to my doctors, kind of on a one-to-one basis. I could, I could get in to see them, without kind of drop in the office maybe and get in to see them. It will take me right now the better part of a week of phone calls to get through to my primary care physician. I never really know what's going on. As all of you are aware, I went through major surgery at the beginning of this session. Cardiologist at Oregon Health Science indicated it was kind of a walking time bomb. The procedures that were performed to make the initial diagnosis were performed on a Thursday afternoon. I did not receive any confirmation of what those tests were until the following Wednesday, when I finally was able to get through the maze of telephone system that was in place in that particular health care facility. Now, you might say that that maybe I should change primary care physician. Have any of you changed primary care physicians recently? I submit that that's not the easiest thing in the world to do, especially if you're in Eastern Oregon, because there is not a doctor in Pendleton, to my knowledge, that's taking new primary care physicians, patients. There are only two in Walla Walla, which is where I go, who are taking new patients. And I'm not talking about Oregon Health Plan patients, obviously, in this case. And it even gets more difficult when we get down there. So part of my real concern with this is the change in the way healthcare is being delivered in the United States. And at least I personally feel a real burning need to have that information. The information could, the information could have been provided me immediately after the thallium stress test. It wasn't. And I went a week before there was any follow-up on that, and I seriously questioned whether that was a wise sort of thing to do. So, again, thank you very much for your indulgence, and appreciate your hearing this bill, and appreciate the testimony of all those who testified. I don't know whether they're planning to testify or not, but I believe, and you can check with them here, I believe the Oregon Health Sciences University is neutral on the bill.
Yes, we did get that indication. So, thank you, Representative. Oh, Representative Dalto, you wanted to comment on the state of health care in 1969?
Regrettably, Mr. Chair, one of us is able to do that, but the other is not. No, Representative Jensen, did I understand you to say that you leave the state of Oregon and drive to another state to get your health care?
No.
You drove to Walla Walla to see a physician? Is that where your physician is?
Yes, that's all of 40 miles.
Well, I realize that, but something wrong. It seems something wrong about having to leave Oregon to get your health care needs met. But I have a serious question for you, which is that do you feel if you had access to the results from the laboratory that you would have been able to interpret those results or understand what they meant?
Very clearly.
Great. Thank you.
And I would have been at the one of the facilities here in the more metropolitan than area Monday morning rather than 2 weeks later.
Representative, would you we aren't moving this bill today. Clearly we have two amendments and we also have some clarification on HIPAA that I would like to have before we move this thing, and I'm hoping that Representative Jensen and Mr. Martinez can make sure definition and language is acceptable, but we will bring this back.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Mona Sanders.
And I would like to make sure that clarification regarding how the labs would deal with false positives, HIV, those critical things that Mr. Martinez had mentioned. I am concerned about those types of results being given.
And I guess I'm another curiosity that just struck me, because we talked safety net clinics and the testing done there, which is still, I mean, it could be not necessarily a primary care physician in charge of that necessarily, and so I'm wondering how that plays into this also. So just one more little trigger that we might need to make sure that we're... I mean, we need to do due diligence on this, Representative, but I understand your issue and I support it, and I do want to do this once we get everything aligned. So thank you very much for bringing this.
Thank you, Representative Cruz and Chair Cruz. And just one closing statement. Remember, it's your body.
Oh, God, I was hoping for a different one. Okay. I don't know where that came from. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2631. Must be Friday. And we're going to open an informational meeting, invited testimony, prescription patient assistance program, community perspectives, and where do we start in?
Right here.
Let's start at the top. Delina Porter.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, and interested. My name is Dorothy Delina Porter. I'm 55 years old, and I'm a resident of Benton County, and I'm a physical health consumer, and I'm a mental health consumer. I thought I'd be addressing several different cuts and the confusion that they've caused, but I see on this agenda that I'm supposed to maybe confine it more to the prescription patient assistance program. And I'd like to know, is that so?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?
I had intended to make my comments like maybe two or three, four parts. On the different medical cuts of mental health particularly and the hassle of prescription patient assistance program. And then I see this agenda this morning and it says prescription patient assistance program, and I wonder if I'm supposed to focus my remarks specifically to that program.
Please do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. I will say that last week, by the way, I'm not used to doing this.
fine.
Last week, I arrived on the wrong day. I was supposed to be here Thursday with NAMI, and I got here on Friday and thought, well, I'm here. I might as well do something. So I came into this room, and there was a meeting going on. I did not hear the name of the man testifying because I came in after he started, but he was a representative from Pfizer Drug Company. And he made several statements last week that I was just itching to comment on, and I didn't know if I'd be allowed to do so. And they said, come back today and do so. But one of the things he addressed was shopping around for medicines. He said that some Pfizer reps went to several different pharmacies and got quotes on a generic drug all the way from $2 to $100. And what I wanted to go on record is saying that for the average mental health consumer to shop around is naive. They're lucky, some of us, if we get to the pharmacy at all. And that's the one we chose and we're stuck with on our form. The Pfizer representative did not address that on our medical cards it states what pharmacy we have to go to. So what would be the point in shopping around if we have to go to a certain one? But if a certain one's not going to cover us anymore, does that mean it's okay if we shop around? And so the confusion is great. Many mental patients, clients, do not have a car, or they have a car but no gas money, or they have a car and gas money, but they have extreme anxiety disorder about going out and asking about prices and forms and whether they'll do it right or they'll do it wrong. I know from personal experience. I'm not a stupid person, but I do get overwhelmed very easily. I'm not a shy person, but I'm very sensitive. And this is so upsetting to me. I got a lady who's active in mental health with NAMI to help me with some forms to apply for these physician assistance programs. And even with the help, very, very kind and professional help of someone else besides myself, it still took hours and hours. She did a lot of the form filling out because I personally sort of freak when I see a form. I know there are other mental health consumers that also freak out when they see anything that affects their housing, their medicine, their safety, their food. They oftentimes will not open their mail even. And I brought mail. I have it open to prove it. And I know I'm not alone. So and let me get back on track here a little bit.
You're doing fine.
Oh, okay. I was getting help with the different pharmacies. It's a nightmare. I have a list of prescriptions that I'm supposed to take every month. They total $396. My income is $658. Now, how I'm supposed to do that, I'm not really sure. But all of a sudden, with very little notice, I got told, do this. And then my social services worker that works for the state of Oregon said that this is a bunch of, and I'll spell it, C-R-A-P. And I didn't think that's the best word in the world to use, but I thought if my social services worker said that my medical card was that, probably right. It probably is that. And so I'm trying to get help, and I have like 7 or 8 different medicines. Some I take are generic because that's all that the Medicaid. I was on the medically needy program. And that's all that would pay for was generic. Some are, what's the word for non-generic? Like the
branded.
Real thing?
Branded.
Pardon me?
Branded.
Okay, some are branded, some are generic. I'm supposed to figure out whether the patient's assistance program that I'm supposed to send in applies to the generic or the branded. And if I don't know those names, I'm supposed to find them out. And I'm supposed to do this on the first part of the month when I've just been informed that I can't get my prescriptions, when the pharmacies are horribly busy and the psychiatrist isn't available to talk to and the medical doctor's not available to talk to. And I can't find out for a while. I'm not a drug researcher. I'm just a citizen of Oregon. And so we get it figured out, every manufacturer. And then some of the forms, and I brought some copies of some of them, allow you to fax them. Well, I don't know very many mental health consumers with their own fax machine, but maybe, you know. Some you can do a toll-free number, but only the doctor can call. The consumer can't call. Some they want your last year's tax return. Well, I don't make enough money to file a tax return last year. Then they want a certified form stating that you didn't file a tax return. And it's like, give me a break, you know, while I'm trying to figure out and satisfy all these requirements, my stomach's burning, my anxiety disorder's flaring up to the point where I'm overwhelmed, I'm thinking about suicide, and it's like I try to get focused again. I'm not sure if I can keep my therapist, but that's another subject apparently. And I think, okay, I can do this because I've got this helpful lady. And I thought, what about all the consumers in Oregon, thousands of them, who don't have this helpful lady? What are they doing? You know, and I talked to I had 3 different doctors to go and get different signatures from, the psychiatrist, the stomach surgeon, and the primary care physician. They each had prescribed things because that's what they did. And each doctor's office has different rules. Each pharmaceutical company has different rules. Two of the stomach surgeon and the stomach surgeon was pretty nice. My regular primary care doctor and my psychiatrist were like well, we can't fax that for you. We can't do this. We can't do this. We're overwhelmed ourselves. And at my doctor's office, I started crying, and I said, forgive me if I'm wrong, but isn't the patient the most important thing about your doctor's office? You know, and they said, well, yes, but we're just overloaded too. And I said, well, you're normally or relatively normal as far as mental stuff, and you have a fax. I'm not normal as far as mental stuff, and I don't have a fax. Now, wouldn't you think that maybe you could send that in for me? I filled it all out, everything but the doctor's signature. That's just for one. I finally called the drug company to see if anything had happened, and I called my psychiatrist to see if he'd heard anything. And he said that he did hear. Well, if I hadn't called him, I wouldn't know. But he said he did get some medicine. So I go over to pick it up, and that's more gas, more going out of the house. A lot of people have agoraphobia. And it seems like the government and the taxpayers and I've been a taxpayer. I had my own company for 15 years in Oregon. But it seems like lots of people think, well, just drive here, do this, do that. And many of us consumers do not have a car. The buses where I live in Corvallis don't run after 7 o'clock at night, and they don't run on Sunday. Cabs are horribly expensive for somebody on welfare or general assistance, which they can't get anymore. But anyway, I think it's so confusing. And if Representative Karen Menes' bill had passed, and we got benefits restored to June 30th, we would have probably had to go back and change all of our prescriptions again to generic again. And this trying to get new prescriptions from, like in my case, 3 doctors, and no, I need a prescription for this. No, I need it for that. No, I need, well, okay, I don't need it for this. Oh, you have free samples of this one? Oh, okay. I can hardly keep track of all of it. And so I just want to say I think it's, sure, it's a help. I did get a Together RX card after about 3.5 weeks. They did actually send me one in the mail. I guess I'm supposed to take it to a pharmacy and get drugs for $12 a prescription. But that's still, and it only covers 3 drugs that I happen to take. So that's still $36, which is, about a little bit over 5% of my income, if I'm figuring right. And then I still, how am I going to pay for the other drugs? And it's like you have your RX card in one hand and your new prescription in the other hand and your prescription for the generic and your tax form and your form about whether you file taxes. And expecting mental health consumers to keep track of all this when some of them are lucky if they can keep track of what medicines they're supposed to keep every day and do their dishes and go to their therapist. And I'm a little more functioning than that, but it's a hardship. It's a real hardship.
I'm sure you're speaking for many people, Ms. Porter.
Pardon me?
I'm sure you're speaking
thank
for many people.
Do you pronounce it Tomei?
Tomei,
Representative
yes.
Tomei, thank you.
Thank you.
I know I do. I am the only certified peer counselor in Benton County who was trained and certified by the Mental Health Department to counsel other people with mental illness. And I've been on chairman of the board for the Accountable Behavioral Health Alliance, which is a 5-county sort of a health insurance group that covers for people on the health plan. I served there for 2 years. I'm very active with other consumers, and they are hurting. They're scared.
I'm sure that's true.
I would invite questions, I guess.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Porter? Thank you very much for testifying.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Oh, okay. We have next on our list Ellen Penny and Tim Miller.
Thank you. Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Ellen Pinney. I'm Executive Director of the Oregon Health Action Campaign. I first want to extend my sincere gratitude to Chairman Cruz for agreeing to have this hearing from basically on the consumer perspective on the accessibility of pharmaceutical assistance programs. These programs are being touted as the solution for people whose prescription needs are not covered. The essence of what you hear today and what you have just heard should make it clear that when these programs work, it is indeed a wonderful thing. But the programs are complicated, they're fickle, they're short-term, they're inconsistent, they're wildly diverse in their requirements, and full of uncertainty for those who need them most. They are no solution. Relying on them to fill the need is like relying on a Band-Aid to stop a hemorrhage. Our organization is home to several projects which I think are particularly relevant to the issue at hand. We have a health helpline and have recently been funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation through Covering Kids and Families to help people who are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and Family Health Insurance Assistance Program navigate the application process to get into those programs. Our helpline has recently been inundated with calls from people who are seeking access to these programs and help in enrolling in them. And we do not have dedicated staff or funding for these efforts like many of the other organizations that are being called on to do this work right now. And we struggle, as you will hear, and are frustrated in our efforts to meet the need. We have talked to pharmaceutical manufacturers. We have said that the most important thing they could do to make their programs successful is to come up with one single application form, as hospitals have done for financial assistance, to come up with a single sliding fee scale, and to cover all their drugs. They have so far been unwilling to do this, but I have to say that if they really wanted to make their programs accessible, that is what they would need to do. You know, when we receive news and we're delighted that prescription drugs are covered for OHP standard, it's clear that people who are providers in this state recognize that medicine without prescription drugs is not medicine. That's why a number of health plans dropped out of OHP standard when they learned that prescription drugs were no longer going to be covered. We're delighted that they've been reinstated for the standard population. As you may know, only 400 of the 8,000 people on medically needy will see their medicines reinstated. In addition, there are 423,000 Oregonians who are uninsured and some 780,000 Oregonians who remain uninsured for prescription medicines. People who lack drug coverage and are prescribed medicines have few choices. They can pay the highest rates of any purchaser over the counter at pharmacies. Providers give them limited samples. Most often these samples are designed to entice providers and consumers to try newer, more expensive drugs. And they can do things that they can to get the cheapest drugs possible. They can try to hook up with Canadian pharmacies where drugs are potentially 40 to 60% less than many of the same drugs you buy in this country. They can take a trip to Mexico. They can try to get access to generic drugs if generic drugs are an alternative that will work for them. The Senior Drug Assistance Program, which has recently been launched, if you are an elder who qualifies, meaning you have not had insurance for prescription drugs for at least 6 months, will give you there's some other eligibility criteria. That program will give people who can afford the $50 enrollment fee and the cost of the medications access to Medicaid rates of participating pharmacies. This program will fill a niche, and it pays for itself. It should be supported. Yet even with Medicaid prices, if you have a high need for drugs or a number of drugs that you're taking, these programs don't really work for you. I think it's interesting that Senate Bill 9, the bill that launched the prescription, the Senior Drug Assistance Program, also had another part which has not been implemented, and that was a toll-free number that was designed to connect people with a compassionate care, kind of a central place where you could get updated information about programs. As I think you will hear in our experience, trying to create these centralized places for people to go for information, it's really not sufficient. People without drugs can do one other thing. They can do without drugs. And then all of us pay the price. We pay the price because when medications are needed and not received, manageable conditions. become more costly. People wind up in emergency rooms. People lose jobs. People are institutionalized. And Oregon pays much more to respond to what could have been appropriately dealt with up front. In the context of understanding the testimony that will be presented to you today, it's really important to understand the medically needy program. It's a spend-down program for people whose income is above the federal poverty level. I have attached a green sheet for your information with the federal poverty level on it. They are people whose incomes or whose monthly prescription, mental health, and medical needs bring their incomes well below the poverty level. In fact, in order to qualify, you have to, when your medical, you have to spend down to what's called the SSI level, which is $552 a month. Federal poverty level for a single person is $748 a month. Some people on medically needy have incomes as high as $1,000 and prescription drug costs of $1,400. Some people on medically needy have income as low as $800 and prescription drug costs of $400. 20% of the medically needy program costs went to mental health. As you all know, the only component of mental health of medically needy that's been reinstated is HIV, some HIV medications for some subset of the population that's yet to be determined, and some subset of the drugs utilized by people with transplants. I think everyone in this room is kind of wondering who's going to be covered and when. We've heard the earliest this program would restart in some capacity would be April 1st. I think it's also significant that the money that was allocated is general fund only. So we have replaced a program that got federal matching dollars and therefore brought in over $15 million to the state when you include the federal match with a $1 million program. I can't end my part of this testimony without saying that and asking that you all, as leaders in health policy in this state, do everything you can to expand access to coverage for people in need and to maintain the Oregon Health Plan. This is not only good for Oregon's health, for the health of our families, it's good for our economy. I've attached a copy of the report. I'm hopeful many of you have already seen a copy of the Families USA report talking about how much money one single Oregon dollar or how much money an investment in Medicaid brings in for Oregon. And I encourage you to use that information as you ponder how best to deal with health care in this state. Tim Miller is our health helpline coordinator and has been kind of on the front lines of frustration and delight in attempting to hook up folks who need access to prescription access programs in our office. Great, thank you.
Chairman Cruz, committee members, interested parties, for the record, my name is Timothy Miller. I'm the health helpline coordinator for the Oregon Health Access Project. Here to provide testimony today as to why the indigent patient programs, or PAPs, do not provide an adequate safety net for the 110,000 Oregonians enrolled in OHP standard, or the approximately 8,000 who have lost prescription coverage under the recently eliminated medically needy program. When OHP standard and medically needy enrollees were informed that they were about to lose their prescription coverage, our health helpline was inundated with calls from people desperately trying to find how they're going to get their meds. Our helpline was originally set up to provide assistance for families applying for the Oregon Health Plan, but since this crisis has happened, over 60% of our calls have all been related to getting access to medications. At first, I thought that maybe these programs would be an alternative to the loss of a prescription benefit, but we've been forced to see that these programs do not meet the need at all. As Paul Nielsen of the Pharmacia Corporation recently stated in testimony, the PAPs could best be described as a small rescue boat in a stormy sea. They do not provide any true solution to the lack of a prescription drug coverage benefit. Many medications are not covered by these programs. Cystic fibrosis and Crohn's disease patients, provide two examples of people within the medically needy population who have been cut off from prescription coverage and for whom the PAPs offer little or no assistance. Attached, you will find a list from needymeds.com, which lists some of the medications that are not available through the PAPs. It will also give you a good idea of how often the rules, the availability of medications and programs themselves change. People are referred to us from many sources, including state workers, medical clinics, hospitals, social workers, probation officers, churches, our own volunteers, schools, etc. Since January, we've been receiving over 70 documented calls and at least double that number of undocumented calls per month. This represents only a small fraction of the need. The way these programs are set up provides a whole host of barriers to people needing access.
Can I clarify that? So you're saying this hotline has received 70 calls?
Per month since January, and those are documented calls. Things
and what's the difference between documented and undocumented calls?
Well, the undocumented calls have an intake form filled out on them, and they're in a filing system. And there's a lot more extensive work done to them, a lot more records, statistical information has been taken. Sometimes so many calls come in so fast that, and we have such few staff and volunteer, we just, a lot of them slip through and don't become documented.
Thank you. Please proceed.
The way these programs are set up provides a whole host of barriers to people needing access to medications. These programs vary, so the rules are going to change. But usually, you must have a physician request the forms, fill out part of the forms, send the forms back to the company, and be willing to receive the medications at their office. The patient must go to the office and pick them up, and the physician must resubmit paperwork every 60 to 90 days in order to get the next 3-month supply. Unless you have all your medications made by the same manufacturer, you may have to go through the whole process several times. We have callers who need a dozen or more medications, all from different companies. Many families do not have internet access, and therefore access to the PAPs themselves can be very difficult. Already we've heard of at least one clinic in Portland which, due to the large number of requests, is now charging patients $7 for the initial application and $3 for every subsequent application that people are requesting assistance on. These charges alone will take away a truly low-income person's last opportunity to get free medications. Right? And this is an example of how the free market will react when deluged with requests for assistance, which there is no recompensation. These PAPs represent a wide variety of programs with no central coordination. Each program has its own rules, all of which makes it very confusing to someone faced with a life-threatening illness or suffering from the stress and confusion of mental illness. As brand-name medications become available as generics, many of the brand-name medications are removed from the PAPs list but remain unavailable as generics. Some PAPs bar legal immigrants from access to programs. Some PAPs bar undocumented workers from participation. Many people have co-pays that force them to pay up to 70% of the cost of their own prescription medicines. All of these people are barred from participating in these programs because they at least have some prescription benefit. Right? Many companies have limits as to how long a patient can participate. Some companies charge small fees in order to access their programs. These are fees which the poorest of the poor cannot afford. Many pain medications and narcotics are not available at all. Many patients have been cut off from their providers either because they cannot afford co-pays or because they've been dropped from managed care plans by OHP and cannot find a provider who accepts the open card. It takes a minimum of about 30 days for most of the applications to be processed and for the medications to be sent to the doctor's office. Even then, there are no guarantees. Many patients need their meds now, not in 30 days or more. In summary, I believe that it is vital for you all to understand that while these programs can and do help many people, they are not able to, nor were they ever designed to meet the needs that we're facing today. Unless these programs are dramatically reformed, invested in, and advertised on a scale comparable to what the pharmaceutical companies do now to get us to buy their newest drugs, I doubt very much that they could ever begin to meet the need that exists in Oregon today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? These two presenters?
Yes,
You mentioned the federal poverty level, and do you know how that formula is, how they come by that formula? I've read before, and I've forgotten what it is.
How they come up with the federal poverty level formula? You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I don't know how they come up with that formula. There might be someone in the room who doesn't, but who does. But if there isn't, I will get that information back to you.
Okay, thanks. It seems to me that they're using some of that information. It was pretty outdated.
Those of us who are advocates in this room, I think, would all agree that this federal poverty level is no indication of what it takes to live comfortably with a roof over your head and decent food and the health care you need.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate you getting that to me.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, you mentioned that a number of different groups are working on this project, and I'm impressed. You also mentioned civil and faith-based. It's been a very happy experience of mine working in Justin County. Many of the different faith-based churches have come together with our community services to raise money. Have you raised much money from these groups here to buy some of these medications or pay for access to the plans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that's a very good question. Our coalition members pay money to contribute to advocacy efforts. I think that there are some foundations that are interested in stepping forward. We get a large amount of money from foundations. There are some that are interested in stepping forward to figure out how they can fill the need. But it will not be in any way or shape, I think, directed to purchase of pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. It will be in efforts to try to link people up.
Good way to go. You have some pretty powerful groups here.
We're talking about programs. If you just look at the medically needy program that covers 8,000 people, a $15 million price tag. That
I'm not saying you've covered all, but that's a good place to start.
Thank you for that suggestion.
Thank you. Tim, I have a question. I guess I was amazed at the number of calls when you mentioned there were 70 documented. I was expected many, many, many more than that.
If we were to really go out and advertise that we're doing this on a wide scale, I'm sure we could get many, many more than what we're getting. But I've just 2 weeks ago, I just trained 15 new volunteers to help us. We're just getting them in place now. As we get more capacity, we'll be more public about the help by getting more publicity out before.
Mr. Chair, could I address that question as well? We our helpline has never been formally advertised, as Tim suggested. We really do exist to help people with the Oregon Health Plan applications, and we are concerned that if we advertise ourselves, like for example the governor's ombuds office has, as a solution, we would be inundated with calls from people who we really can't help in the way we would like to be able to help people, which is not go to this website, because people don't have access to computers. It is not call this number. It is let us help you, connect you with the pharmacy that you need. There are others in this room who will come after us who probably are dealing much more directly and in much greater volume with patients and who are clinicians who can speak to how their volume has been impacted.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
You know, just to pick up on Ms. Penny's point, I spoke with Jen Dennison last week, and she's doing 14-hour days in the ombudsperson's office, and her whole team, they're just being incredibly inundated because we have all been advised to refer tough cases to her. And so as our colleagues are doing that, and a lot of other folks, and you know, I saw Jen's number on television the other day in the news, I can attest to what happens when you advertise. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, we did call Jim Dennison to see how they were dealing with the calls and whether they were providing the kind of hand-holding assistance that many people need to wade through these forms, and they don't have the capacity to do that either. They are really saying, here's a list of companies. And the list that they have been handing out, actually, of the various access points to these programs, we would not refer some people to some of those places because they are dead ends. So it's really about, and I think advocacy organizations are all struggling to figure out how they can try to meet the need. It's about figuring out which places you can send people to actually do work to give you current information. And actually the assistance you may need to get into these programs.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Could we hear now from Rob Wheaton and Don Golden? Okay. We have, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people after this. So I'm going to ask people to keep their testimony a little bit short.
Yeah, we'll keep it short.
Thank you.
My name is Rob Wheaton. I had a heart transplant. I am an OHSU cardiology patient as well as Representative Jensen, I believe it was up here. And, you know, I couldn't help but think when he was lamenting about the phone system at OHSU, what a piece of cake that is compared to filling out these forms that everyone's been talking about. I mean, I can get a hold of my cardiologist within 5 minutes. I mean, maybe I should give him some tips because it's probably the same one. But I sat down to fill out these forms with the help of my social worker and about 10 other patients. And, I mean, I was overwhelmed. I mean, there is a lot of paperwork here. I'm someone that fills out forms on a regular basis. I do work for, you know, on a consulting basis for labor unions. So, I mean, I can fill out all the paperwork it takes to comply with the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, but I can't quite figure out how to do all this patient assistant program work. Not to mention the fact that when I sat down and did it, I discovered that 3 out of the 6 medications that I take, which totals $1,500 a month, were covered by a particular PAP program. The rest, you know, I have to find on my own. Other than that, you know, I really don't have too much to add, so I mean, try to keep it pretty brief. Like I said, there's a lot of work, and I filled this paperwork out in late January. I still haven't heard. Thank God I was able to get some that final mail order prescription for 90 days off of the medically needy program. So I've been okay because as of, I think it was March or February 3rd or something, I would have been out of pills. Of course, if, you know, a heart transplant patient runs out of pills, their immune system attacks their heart, cell damage, heart failure, death in about 4 or 5 days. So I'm still alive, thank you. Don, anything to add?
My name's Don Golden. I'm a recent heart transplant, OHSU, 3 years out. Rob and I are here representing hundreds of transplant people that are really not strong enough to make it. We look healthy, but believe me, we're still emotionally and physically weak. From a near-death experience and taking the medications, it does take its toll on us. I have recently started a support group through OHSU, referrals to me, trying to help people in my situation, transplants. I'm really one of the fortunate ones. I see so many people that are not able to represent themselves, to ask for help. I had to chuckle when the representatives here said you had to go out of state for your medical health. We have to go out of the country for our drugs, and OHSU cannot help us with whether these drugs are up to speed as far as U.S. produced. They can't give opinions on that. I mean, we're on our own. A lot of this, you have to have a computer. As I say, I'm fortunate enough, I do have a computer. I can do it myself. But some of the people that I've talked to, other heart transplants, are not able to do this. And as I say, the process is very draining, extremely draining on us. I'll briefly give you my history. In 1995, I was diagnosed with congestive heart failure. Over an 8-year period, I've completely drained my resources. Right now, I receive $872 from Social Security. I am on Medicare, which handles my immunosuppressant medication, and also I do have a supplemental insurance. But my supplemental insurance costs me $124 a month. My medications I have to take to counteract my immunosuppressants run about $550 a month. So that takes a big chunk out of my $872. I do own my own home, which I'm in the process of selling. I have to cover my living expenses. If I live long enough, I'll run out of money. If I don't, well, I'll have money left over. So that basically is my story. Any questions?
Any questions of either of these gentlemen? Representative.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just had a question for Mr. Wheaton. The drugs that you take to prevent the rejection of your transplant, is that indefinitely? Is that forever?
Yeah, I mean, your immune system will always think of the heart as a foreign particle and, try to kill it. As time goes on, I'm lucky enough to come down to 6 medications. When you first come off of it, I mean, there was dozens. You had all these pill boxes, you had to take this at certain times. When you first come off it, there's a lot more as far as antibacterial medications and these stuff that you got to take. I forget them all. But I'm fortunate to be down to 6, and I will have to take those 6 for the rest of my life. One other thing to note, too, when we're talking about Medicare coverage of immunosuppressants, Medicare only covers immunosuppressants if you're on Medicare when you get the transplant. If you become eligible for Social Security and get your transplant before 2 years, that window period before you become eligible for Medicare, you're not going to have your immunosuppressants covered. Now, there's a bill currently before the feds there to change that. But as it stands right now, a lot of people are left out of that Medicare window. So.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Nanette Ringling.
I'm also a first-timer.
Just identify yourself. That'd be great.
My name is Nanette Ringring, and I'm the clinic coordinator of Portland Adventist Community Services Health Clinic. Basically, it's run by all volunteers other than myself, all my physicians, the medical assistants, my practitioners, and volunteers. And the patients that we do see are at or below 135% of the USDA poverty guidelines, and they are uninsured. In 2002, this last year, we had 1,657 patients visits, which was 20% over 2001. We were able to enroll 209 of our patients into these pharmaceutical patient assistant programs. We received $77,000 worth of free medications for our patients. And for this, we're very grateful, as our patients, without their help, would be gravely ill. They could possibly have a stroke or end up in an emergency department. So, because they can't afford these on their own, a lot of the medications are very expensive. However, in utilizing these programs for the past few years, my staff and I have come across these following barriers. I have outlined them for you, so it shouldn't be for easy reference. But basically, it's the forms that are so difficult. We have a lot of patients who do not read or write or speak English, either because of a lack of education or because they are foreign-born immigrants. And some of the programs that we utilize a lot require a phone call for each patient individually as the patient is there, which takes up to 30 minutes per phone call, which takes a lot of time, especially when you have a volunteer staff. Several applications require specific income verifications and or copies of federal income tax forms, and patients who have not been employed in more than a year or are homeless do not have accurate records and are therefore ineligible for enrollment. Medications do have to be signed personally by patients and providers every 6 weeks in order to receive a continuous supply of their medications. This is extremely difficult for most of our patients as they live in a state of daily crisis. For example, their immediate need may be to find food or lodging. Transportation is also a common challenge for a lot of our patients. Most programs require Social Security numbers. This eliminates elder immigrants and all undocumented patients from any of these programs. All programs also must have a provider's original signature, and some also require original prescriptions to be mailed with the enrollment forms. This can be a little bit confusing when you have a patient who has quite a few different medication project papers, because some do require prescriptions, some do not. If you do not send in exactly what they want, they will be rejected. Patients also have multiple medications and several applications. Unfortunately, because of the pharmaceutical companies merging and drugs being bought and sold continuously, the enrollments and the requirements change often. So we may have sent in 20, 30 applications, and they'll all come back because Park Davis was just bought out by a Pfizer company. In fact, that actually just happened. Patients who do qualify do have to wait 4 to 6 weeks for their first shipment of medication. Pharmaceutical supplies and samples are not plentiful enough to gap this bridge before the patients receive medications. Pharmaceutical companies are also not required to have any of these patient assistant programs, and they are not a guaranteed source of medications for our patients. In fact, some companies do not facilitate any type of a patient assistant medication program, and overutilization can cause closure of programs that we saw with Monarch Pharmaceuticals. They closed their program for 10 months, and then King Care also bought them out. Thank you for your time and attention to this matter. It is one of my passions, because I have been in this arena for many years.
Thank you, Ms. Ringerling. Any questions of Ms. Ringerling? Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to call Marcia Katz and William Glenning. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, good morning. My name is Marcia Katz, and I can do this in 3 minutes, I think.
Thank you, Marcia.
My name is Marcia Katz. I am 63 years old, and I have Crohn's disease. I was a nurse for 30 years. When money was given back to the prescription assistance programs, people in my situation were left out. I did not meet the required criteria. I take a total of 15 different drugs every month. A few are as needed. The rest are taken every day. On doctor's prescriptions, I take 14 over-the-counter supplements to help with my Crohn's disease, as I do not absorb food correctly. On top of that, as needed, last year I paid $280 for new eyeglasses, $225 for dental work, $127.67 monthly for my Medicare supplement. I lost my medical coverage under ballot measure number 5. I pay $20 a year for my medical alert bracelet update. I also pay my dermatologist $100 a year for treatments for my face for food allergies, as you can see how red my face is. These allergies all stem from my Crohn's disease. Medicare considers this cosmetic and will not pay for it. I am not yet a diabetic, but I am what is called a borderline diabetic. I therefore am supposed to test my blood twice a day. The diabetic test strips are approximately $1 each, and I have put it on hold because of the cost. My Social Security check is $777 a month. From that, not counting the above expenses, there is still my rent, phone, utilities, food, over and above food stamps for my special Crohn's diet, and, of course, personal items, bus tickets, rent, laundry, clothes, etc., and my medications and my over-the-counter supplements come to approximately $1,300 a month. I have contacted all the pharmaceutical companies that make my prescription drugs. Two of the three drug companies first said they would cover me, Procter & Gamble and TAP, also Merrick, but I haven't heard from Merrick yet. TAP, who makes Prevacid, my doctor twice faxed in to TAP to TAP for the Prevacid. I made a mistake on here. And twice they told me that they stated that they did not have records of either fax, either application. Meaning they, quote, they threw my applications away because of some reason they haven't accepted me. This is a statement made to me by one of their customer service reps when I called in. Procter & Gamble sent me a letter stating that I had been accepted. When I called later to ask when the medicines would arrive, I was informed that a mistake was made and I was not accepted into their program because they believed me to be allergic to one of the ingredients, which I am not. I have been on this drug for 8 years and doing wonderful on it. My other drugs are off patent now and are on with generic pharmaceutical companies. All of these companies told me the same thing. We have chosen not to participate in the drug assistance programs. That's the generic pharmaceutical company saying that. These companies are Ferndale Labs, Warner, Becton Dickinson, Mylan, Seal, Schwartz Pharma, Ordno-McNeil, 3M, Sidmark, PurePak, Mutual, and Eon Labs. I have received the Together card, the Orange card, the Pfizer card, and the Eli Lilly card. Unfortunately, all four cards together only cover two of the medications that I need. Those are the two medications, Coumadin and Vicodin, that I will need after my knee replacement surgery next month. They are absolutely no help to me at all. I implore you, please do not let people like me die. I've paid my dues for 30 years helping other people. I'm asking you now to please help me. P.S. I thought of three suggestions. One, what about giving 50% coverage, but give it coverage to everyone instead of just a few? Two, do what Medicare does. Take a monthly premium out of our Social Security checks to help with the prescription coverage costs. And three, make the benefit packages smaller so that everyone can receive some help, not just a few people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcia. William.
Representative Cruz and Representative Dalton and Representative Tomei, all of you, thank you for your time. I appreciate that. When I was stricken with mental illness, my life...
Can you hear me? Can you tell us your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, William Glennon.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yes.
When I was stricken with mental illness, my life digressed at times to not much more than cold highways, broken down rooms, and institutions. Because of my illness, I lost my wife and my children. The losses I suffered, the pain I felt, did not keep me from trying to go on. Up until 5 years ago, I worked to support myself and my family. But finally, the day came when I was unable to work anymore. With regret, I applied for Social Security. In these last 4 years, I have worked as a volunteer for the Oregon Health Action Campaign, Project Equality, and just recently, the Salem Library. During this time, I have written a book based on my life and the mental illness I suffer. For the first time in my life, I had a peace about who I am and where I am going. That was until approximately 5 weeks ago. I received a notice from the state of Oregon that as of January 31st, 2003, I no longer have any medically needy insurance. My prescriptions alone range between $400 and $500 a month. I bring in $637 a month. That is what I have to cover all the bases necessary to stay alive. I cannot afford both the prescriptions and my life expenses, yet my life depends on them. There are many of us that share the same predicament. Since I received news of my lack of coverage, I have been seeking the benevolence of those pharmaceutical companies that produce the medications that I rely on. The period between the application for and the reception of drugs is a no man's land. There is no tracking to see if one has been approved or not. If not, then it may be too late to apply elsewhere, leaving a gap in coverage and maybe no medication for a week or two. This is a very serious thing to most people on psychotropic drugs. It would break down, and by then it would be too late. The application, coordination with your doctor, if you still have one, keeping track of what medications you have and what you need is not an easy task. The present state of mental health services will attest to that. When did they hang up the telephone for the last time to the frightened, bewildered voices who can't make sense of it all? They are hurting. Those who are giving help and those who are receiving it, they are hurting. And seemingly there is nothing we are doing about it. I appeal to you, my government's representatives, to consider what is happening. I and many others are suffering now because our lives have been predominated by financial concerns. In the most lucid of moments, we would reason that humanity is of highest priority. But I fear these days are quickly coming to an end. all of the accomplishments, all of the normalcy, all of the efforts to live quality lives lead to nothing. Many lives brought to naught because of our short-sightedness. We who rely on the state of Oregon are not expendable. Being disabled is not a choice. Many of us are helpless, and yet each of us does what he or she can to assure wellness. We are living, breathing human beings. If we are not made a priority, then our society is quickly being ushered into a very dark set of years. You can help to change the course we're on. I ask you to do what you can.
Thank you, Mr. Glennon. I'm not going to, unless there's some very important questions, I think we'll move on to the next speakers. Thank you both very much. I'd like to call Robert Childs and Tim Nesbitt, please.
First of all, I'd like to thank the council for letting me speak today. I have a lot of gratitude to you all for letting me do so. My name is Robert Childs. I work with Cascadia Behavioral Health Care as an assertive community treatment clinician. I work with the highest hospital utilizers in Portland, and due to their mental health criteria, assertive community treatment, also known as ACT, is a treatment approach designed to provide comprehensive, community-based psychiatric treatment, rehabilitation, and support to persons with serious and persistent mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder and bipolar manic disorder. About one-fourth of my clients have been affected by the budget cuts in a treacherous manner. Some of the state's most needy clients have lost all outpatient services and medications. Without medications and outpatient services, my client base becomes disorganized, lose touch with reality, experience increased auditory and visual hallucinations, suicidal ideations, which means they have constant thoughts of killing themselves, mania, depression, anger, and extreme danger to themselves and to other citizens in the community. As a result, the crime rate will rise, emergency rooms will be flooded with people, and countless people will die. In the end, the state will not save a few million dollars, but actually pay 5 to 8 times more than they would have saved by keeping these services. According to the most recent New York Times article, a prescription plan hailed as a model is a budget casualty on March 5th. Some people argue that the prescription patient assistance programs will solve this problem. However, this is not true. The prescription patient assistance programs do not cover all medications that the clients are usually prescribed, and psychiatrists are forced to advise patients which medications they can stop taking so they will suffer the least. Clients who are a danger to themselves and society are going without certain medications that keep them stable, and now they are on the streets of Portland and all around Oregon, as we speak, unstable, volatile, and have increased symptoms of their mental illness. Also, without some key medication, clients have trouble taking care of their basic necessities such as eating food, maintaining their housing, shopping, and taking care of their basic needs. If any of you on the committee would like to see this, I personally invite you to come with me any day of the week along with me and see what I do and see what these people are, how they are dealing with their current dilemmas and how they are suffering. Due to these facts, there is an increased hospitalization rate, which costs the state of Oregon $700 to $1,000 a day per client who is admitted to a hospital. To give you an example of how booked the local Portland hospitals are right now, there is not one open bed in the city, and my clients are being sent down to Corvallis and Salem.
Robert, I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
Are those psychiatric beds or referring to?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. No worries. A second weakness of the prescription patient assistance program is they give clients 3 months of medication at a time without supervision. Some clients who have lost services are not organized enough to take medications without supervision by themselves, and it is a ludicrous thought that someone who has had nurses and pharmacists give them medications for the last few decades will suddenly be able to handle to take care of 3 months of medications at a time. Some people I work with have a literal attention span of 10 seconds. They're not going to be able to handle taking their medications and taking 3 months of medications and storing them. As well, I have some clients who are addicts. And when you're an addict, you sometimes have problems dealing with that much medication, especially benzos. And my clients will sell them, and they will also abuse them, leading to increased hospitalizations and also more crime on the streets in the city of Portland. The third weakness of the prescription patient assistance program is it presumes that the client will be able to figure out the system by him or herself. People who are very symptomatic or have a history of closed head injury cannot figure out the paperwork and processes of this system. Since mental health outpatient services have been gruesomely cut, caseloads exceed into the hundreds, and mental health agencies are no longer to serve one-fourth of their clients due to insurance. This is causing a lot of problems. Thousands of the most acutely ill citizens of Oregon have no aid in navigating the system, thereby leaving them to be without medication, causing them to be symptomatic and decompensating and unable to function in regular society. Ultimately, hospitalizations will be the only source of care they can access, and this will cost the state an incredible amount of money. It is my belief that the prescription patient assistance program in the mental health systems is set up to fail and will cause many of Oregon's most needy medication consumers to go awry, leading them to an increased high-cost hospitalization system, crime, homelessness, psychosis, suicides, and suffering. Oregon needs to reinstate the mental health funding and services, medication coverage for the medically needy, and acknowledge that the prescription patient assistance program is no substitute for the previous medically needy spend-down program and mental health outpatient services. And I, again, would love if any of you would like to come along with me for a day and witness what these people are like without medications and see how disorganized they actually are. So it is a spectacular sight.
Thank you, Robert.
Sure.
Tim.
Vice Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Tim Nesbitt. I'm president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon, and I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who worked with 180,000 working families in Oregon, most of whom are insured, but most of whom, too, have confront the issue of high drug costs in terms of the premiums they pay or the out-of-pocket and deductible costs they pay. And I would submit that the real public policy issue here is how to control costs not just for the poorest of our citizens, but for all Oregonians, especially when about two-thirds of Oregonians get their health coverage through their employers, and probably 50% all told get the health coverage through private employers. So I would urge you to think broadly in terms of solutions to this problem, which reach to first the state as a major purchaser of prescription drugs for the Oregon Health Plan and for state employees, and secondly, the state's potential role as a leader in pooling efforts for purchasing. I have attached in my handout a number of charts, and I'd like to call your attention to one in particular. It's the next to last page, and it's entitled Drug Companies Manipulate Prices, Charging Different Purchasers Different Prices. And I think this one chart tells a lot about the story, about the background of the stories you've been hearing today. It's the uninsured population, the uninsured individuals, who pay the highest prices. And these comparisons are for the same drugs, the same prescription drugs. And what they tell you is that a uninsured individual is likely to pay $100, an insured individual $70, somebody in a Medicaid program $61, and somebody in a hospital or a federal hospital, even lower than that, $60, $52, and $45. The common theme here is the size of the purchaser. The bigger you are, the better the price you get. That's the kind of market we're confronting when it comes to prescription drug prices. Now, discount programs are fine, and if they can knock that $100 down to $90, or in the case of the program you haven't yet funded yet, get some prescription drug prices all the way down to the Medicaid rate for some of the neediest of our citizens, that's fine too. But I think what we learned from this chart is that
the potential here is to organize our purchasing power as broadly as possible in the public sector and the private sector to get a better deal on prescription drug prices. Your budget in the next biennium will allocate more than $1 billion for prescription drug costs to the populations I described. Now, that's state and federal money combined, but still it's a big number. And then when you look at the rate at which prescription drug costs are going up, that's about a 300 and some odd million dollar increase, bigger than the increase you're dealing with PERS. So we would just call your attention to this as a problem which does lend itself to solutions of public and private partnerships. We'd urge you to take a good hard look at the bulk purchasing approach. I think there's great potential there for us to, both in Oregon and with neighboring states, apply some of our buying power to this market, which is so sensitive to the size of the purchasers, and get a better deal on prescription drug prices for all Oregonians. You know, we pay the highest prescription drug costs in the world. We subsidize the research and development of prescription drugs through our tax dollars. We also subsidize an overpriced marketing program through what we pay as consumers. And all of that has to do with this unique market we've confronted with in the United States, unlike any other country, where we pay the highest prices for these products. And we're going to have to organize ourselves better, state by state, and on a multi-state basis, in the public sector, in the private sector, to get better pricing, more affordable prices, for these important products.
Thank you. We have Vern Smith, please, and Rose Spears. Could you identify yourselves, please?
Good morning. I want to say thank you first for allowing me to speak, and I'm going to be very brief. I am Rose Spears. I am the chairperson of Oregon Action from Portland, Oregon. I am a 50-year-old single mother and grandmother. I am now one of the many people who got their prescription drug coverage cut from the Oregon Health Plan standard. Most of the people I know got a letter from the state telling them that they got cut. Walgreens had to tell me my prescription drug coverage was gone. At the beginning of the month, that's last month, I received my new OHP card, and I get monthly automatic refills because I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic with several other maladies. So I take about 11 medications. Walgreens called me and told me that I didn't have prescription drug coverage any longer, and my medication came to $912. My pharmacist asked me, Rose, what do you want me to do? I told him to put it back on the shelf because I couldn't afford it. When Measure 28 fell, basically 1 month I had a co-payment of $35. The next month, I had the full coverage, which was $912. I receive SSD, and I get $728 a month. My rent alone is $373 a month. My medications are more money than I have to live on a month, on a monthly basis. I'm trying to figure out different ways to get some relief, but every place I go, they can't help me because their programs are cut because of Oregon's budget. At this moment, my blood sugar is high, and if I can't get it down without medication, in a few days I will probably have to go into the hospital. My prescription drugs are not a luxury or a choice for me. They are a necessity, and I can't afford to do without them. Just a reminder of what my income is $728 a month. My rent is $373. I get $61 worth of food stamps, and my utilities average about $100. On top of this, I'm expected to pay $912 to live.
Thank you, Russ.
French President, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me this morning. For the record, I am Vern Smith. This is my wife, Carol. I'm a 48-year-old diabetic with liver problems, and a genetic disease that causes my triglycerides to be extremely high. Carol works at a part-time Alzheimer's care facility. My health problem means I am unable to work. We do not have insurance, but make too much to qualify for Oregon Health Plan. Her prescription costs are more than my wife earns. We have spent numerous hours looking for assistance through both public and private programs. Contacted 5 different drug companies' assistance programs, turned down because I'm not old enough to qualify for Medicare. Programs sponsored by the major drug companies, including Pfizer, Bristol Myers Squibb, Johnson & Johnson, and GlaxoSmithKline. These programs do not work for us. If we qualified, we would only had to fill out numerous applications and get our doctor to file a lot of paperwork. The waiting period for these programs are at least a month. I can't go a month without insulin. We also looked to the state for assistance. We were told if we were divorced and lived separately, that I might qualify for help. This was told us by the Social Security Administration. On television, there is a governor's advocate number, and we called, and lines were busy, left messages for them to call back. We have no return calls. Found help through a program offered by Multnomah County. Doesn't cover hospital visits, but it will get my medications at a reduced rate. I don't know how long that's going to be able to last. I'm testifying today because legislature needs to know what it's like not to be able to afford our medications. We go to food banks for help. It's either food or medication or our bills. So we have to make decisions where do we pay the bills or buy the medications to live. It's not right. The drug companies are not the answer. If the drug companies really want to help, they wouldn't increase their prescriptions at 2 or 3 times the rate of inflation. They wouldn't charge people who don't have insurance more than the people who do. They make it possible for people to still to live. The legislature just replaced the funding for prescription assistance for some people. I hope that you will continue that funding into the next budget, but even that is not enough. We want the legislature to enact real solutions to help people like us to access the quality, affordable, and secure health care, and do it soon. We need help. Thank you.
Thank you both for testifying. Thank you. We have Catherine Bax, Eric Langdon, and Bill Hancock, please.
My name is Catherine Bax, and I'm a physician assistant, and I work at Virginia Garcia Clinic. I've been working at Virginia Garcia as a provider and as part of the management team for nearly 9 years. Virginia Garcia is a community clinic in Washington County. Over 75% of our patients are uninsured, and of the 25 that are insured, only these are mostly children under 6. So we've been dealing with the indigent medicine programs, but the prescription assistant programs for the last 9 years because we have uninsured patients. We're now dealing with it for our OHP patients also. So we have, the reality is that we only use these programs to obtain the expensive brand name medication for our patients. If we can, we have the opportunity of having a dispensary in our clinic where we can purchase medications at public health service prices so that it's not, we can purchase them so they're not so expensive for the patients, and then we sell them to the patients pretty much what we buy them for. But for the expensive brand name medications, that's not a reality for us. So this, but the problem with the programs are, is it's so expensive for our staff, our nurses and medical assistants, to spend their time filling out applications, tracking medication reapplication dates, getting patients to bring in tax returns, and for our providers to deal with changing patient medications because the medications are no longer on the program or the eligibility criteria have changed for something else. Most of our patients are not well educated, and filling out the forms is difficult. Generally, the forms need to be filled out by our nursing and medical assistant staff. And even then, many of them are rejected. This is our staff who we train to fill out the forms, who are well educated, and who fill out these forms every day. Even those forms get rejected. This is not something that most patients can do on their own. Our staff also needs to keep track of when the patient is going to run out of the 3-month supply of medications so we can apply for the medications 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the company, before the runout date. If we lose track of this, then the patient is without the medication or has to purchase it until we can reapply and wait the 4 to 6 week turnaround. The other glitch is that if we reapply too early, then the application is rejected and we get it back. Whether because the forms are filled out incorrectly or because we missed the reapplication date, there is a lapse in the medication schedule, which is often dangerous. Since the medications are so outrageously expensive, the providers are then put in the position of temporarily changing them to another medication. And if the medication needs to be purchased, then they need to figure out how many pills exactly does the patient need to buy to get through until they're going to get the medicine for the patient assistance program. This is very time-consuming for the providers, and it's a waste of time. I understand that these programs provide a service, and drug companies need to have rules so they can control who gets this free medication. But is it necessary for each company to have different forms, different rules, different eligibility requirements, and then change all these periodically when the companies merge or whenever they decide to, as well as changing their phone numbers? Each of us at the clinic have suspected at one time or another that this complicated, time-consuming system might exist to weed out all but the desperate and the persistent, which we are at Virginia Garcia. At Virginia Garcia, we have a lot of uninsured patients, and we are motivated to provide low-cost, quality care, so we use the programs. I don't think it is likely that medical practices that only have occasional uninsured patients are going to take the time to figure out all this and then pursue it for the relatively few patients without prescription coverage or who are below the federal poverty level. This is not a cost-effective or practical way to obtain medications for low-income patients at nonprofit clinics that are already financially strapped, or even for profit medical practices where patients don't have prescription coverage.
Thank you.
Good morning. Seems like afternoon already. Chair Cruz and other members of the committee, my name is Eric Landon. I am a person living with AIDS. I am also the co-chair of the Client Advisory Board at the Multnomah County HIV Services Center in Portland, Oregon. I'm also an associate member of the HIV Planning Council on the Planning Committee that distributes Ryan White funds here in the Portland DMA. I'm also a consumer of HIV services. As I said earlier, I'm a person living with AIDS and also on the Medical Needy Spend Out Down program, or was, or will be, maybe, I don't know. I'm also a native Oregonian, and I'm very sad to have to come to appear before this committee in such a situation. I am a living, I guess, miracle of modern medicine, better living through chemistry, I always say, that 1997, when these incredible medications were made available to us, that as I saw all of my friends die and at a very young age, I was fortunate to live through this. I've recently completed my MBA, and like many other people in my position that are dependent on these drugs that are very expensive, as you know, I won't go into more of that. I know that you've heard this many times before, but many in this situation were victims of our own success in that we've lived to this point, dependent on these medications, and now ready to reenter the workforce. And here we come to a point in Oregon's history where we have this dilemma of whether we get our medications or not. And I'm sure you're aware of many of the myths. I won't go into the patient assistance program. You've heard plenty of that, I'm sure. And it is cumbersome, and it does take a lot of work, and people down at the clinic are very dedicated to trying to cover us as much as we can. But it is difficult, and I am very grateful that at least the members from both sides of the aisle have shown leadership in restoring temporarily some of these programs. At least it gives us time to take cover somewhere. Now, some people will get on these programs, and we've been quite successful in doing that to many of the clients down at the clinic, but another wave is coming, as you know, and there are hundreds of people waiting in line to get care, and at $1,500 a month to $5,000 a month, of course, there is no way. Federally, President Bush has signed an increase in Ryan White funding, of which the state will get maybe, they say, $300,000 to $400,000. But what's needed to run the Title II program is several million dollars more. Before the Ryan White funds were leveraged with the state, in that the OHP, they paid OHP premiums, for example, of $6, $8, and leveraged those funds to get very expensive medications. Now these people will be moving from co-pays and premium payments to full cost of drugs. So you go from $6 to $8, $20 to $1,500. So the system is, they've had to put a waiting list. And the Multnomah County HIV Clinic, for the first time in its history, has put out a waiting list on that. One myth, I guess, is that some particular drug categories do have generics. HIV medicines, there are none. They're brands, and they're very expensive. And also, it's a complicated disease in that not only HIV medications are necessary because of side effects, so you'll have heart problems or liver problems, and now we're seeing a great increase in mental illness, which compounds the problem since mental health care is completely being devastated before us. And with these dual diagnoses, if they don't get their mental medications, they will be on the street, and they'll end up in hospitals, and we know what the cost of hospitals are. And we've heard earlier testimony also that not only people going to hospitals that are full in the mental health beds, but also in general hospitals in around the Portland area. And when they show up, I heard one case that they were a paying client. They actually have insurance, went to a hospital. They didn't have room for a paying client because their beds were filled with people who are now falling ill. So looking at long term, I mean, I see short term, I'm very grateful that I do have another 4 months. I'm one of those people on February 9th who got a letter said, you know, run for cover. And the choices are patient assistance program, if I can get on that. Illegal means, which would be to find available drugs from friends or people who are no longer using medications, but there is no system set up for that, and that's very precarious. Or leave the state, which is an option, or become very ill, and well, there's only one end to that. That's to die. And the solutions, I mean, it's going to take some it's going to take incredible leadership from Oregon to find the way to not only reinstate the programs, but you have to find some way to fund them. I understand that I read the other day there's a $2.5 billion cuts coming up. With that in mind, I can only think there's only one way to save any kind of program is to find some source of revenue. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thanks for
that. Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Could I comment just a second?
Sure.
You mentioned the one other alternative that would result in death, and I'm not trying to belittle that minor detail. But in your excellent testimony, you left out the process that you would go through, and I'm not dismissing the human suffering side of that, but the tremendous cost of clogging up the hospitals, shifting the cost to commercial providers, more driving up the cost of commercial health insurance, fewer employers being able to provide health insurance, more people therefore dropping health insurance, going on the Oregon Health Plan or uninsured. I mean, there's the human suffering issue aside, not diminishing that, just the financial aspect. The point you didn't stress that I think was unstated was just the tremendous fiscal impact, of not providing minimal adequate health care. I appreciate you being here.
Exactly. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bill Hancock, and I am a member of the Multnomah County Community Health Council, which is the governing board of the Multnomah County Health Department, and where I just completed my term as chair. I'm also a person living with AIDS who is impacted by the medically needy program, as well as the various drug company patient assistance programs. And much of my experience that you experiences with the patient assistant programs you have already heard today with some slight variation. What I'd like to do is start with, since a lot of what we'll read through after today will basically come down to cost, is the cost of my drugs versus my income. My HIV and heart medications are almost triple my monthly Social Security disability income, and that drug cost amount is based on the third-party price of through the medically needy program, by no means not the retail price from a drug company. So based on an almost $30,000 a year annual drug cost, I was very intimidated and very frightened by the letter that I got from the Department of Human Services in January that said that I would be cut off from my drug benefits and that I would, in a quote, have to pay for my own costs in the future. Well, based on the pharmaceutical cost, even at a third-party price, compared to my disability income, it didn't mean that I was going to be paying for my drugs in the future. It meant that I would be doing without. And at the conclusion of that letter from the Department of Human Services, as a consolation in the last paragraph, I was offered the ability to apply for food stamps, which I found at the time insulting and patronizing. And subsequent to that, I went into and found out about the drug assistance programs and worked with the Multnomah County HIV Clinic to enter those programs. And trying to have basic questions answered by drug companies regarding these patient assistance programs, such as, is this a permanent fix? If it's a temporary fix, how temporary? Is there a copay? If there's a copay, how much? And generalized informational questions about the application process, where in their instructions maybe it wasn't particularly clear to a provider or to another clinician that might be managing that application process. And also just in my role as a board member for the health department, what we were seeing rapidly happening is that the drug company requiring that these application processes be instituted at a provider and clinic level meant that on a local level, county public health and not-for-profit safety net clinics within the safety net system are absorbing huge administrative costs, and it's growing. But once I found out about the stopgap, that there's only a 60 to 90 day assistance from these companies based on what the company is or what drug they provide. For my HIV medications, I'm getting coverage for some but not all. And so I'm faced with the question of asking my physician, can I do without this one, which happens to be the most expensive one that they're not going to cover? Can I do without that? That's not acceptable to him. And also, I recently had to add heart medications because after long-term HIV treatment, in December of last year, I suffered a significant heart attack as a result of HIV drug medication side effects. And because of that, I now have four new medications to add, which I have no coverage for. And a comparison that I would like to give you on drug company logic or maybe illogic based on price is that I'm on four HIV medications and I'm on four heart medications, both of which came with the exact same adherence lecture from my physicians. You must take these medications, you must take them according to the time that we have set, or your life expectancy will be greatly diminished and it will end. My four HIV medications are $2,500 a month, and my four heart medications are $200 a month. And so getting a basic question to the answer of why, coming from my perspective working in developing public policy and helping promote a public health department budget, we can't get answers to those questions, and I find that disturbing that in many ways these costs and how these programs are run and based that drug company marketing, you know, far out exceeds their research. I really think that we need to initiate their conversation at the table about social responsibility when it comes to companies like drug companies that come to Oregon and do business here that have a direct impact on the lives of people, that when they come here to do that business and when they come here to state government for money, that they also have a good understanding of what our values in Oregon are regarding social responsibility when you come here to do a business like that before they gouge state and local government. And that concludes my comments.
Thank you all for your testimony today.
Madam Chair, one quick question. How much are the HIV drugs a month? Round number.
Mine's about 1,500.
Mine run 2,000, 2,200 a month.
And that's not the heart medication?
No.
And also you said they went up to $5,000.
There's a new one coming up, T20. It's about, they've announced the price, I think, for Europe is $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. This is one medication.
So we're 60.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You got it.
Thank you very much. Thank you all in the audience. Mr. Chair, this has been a heartbreaking morning listening to this testimony. I wish that we could have the pharmaceutical lobbyists view the tape of these testimonies so they could realize what these people are going through and how difficult it is for them, even when the drugs are available, how difficult it is to apply for the drugs, and especially difficult for some of the people who are disabled to go through the process. So I don't know if we can do that, but it would certainly be wonderful to at least ask them to view the tapes, if not require them to do so. Are you wanting me to end the meeting?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I say.
You say we are adjourned and bang the gavel.
We are adjourned. Thank you all for coming.
She forgot.